ventilated or crowded indoor settings because aerosols can remain suspended in the air or travel farther than controversial distance. It was a relief to see them finally use the word airborne and to say clearly that airborne transmission and aerosol transmission are synonyms, says aerosol chemist José Luis Jiménez at the University of Colorado Boulder. The seemingly uncontroversial statement marked a clear shift for the Switzerland-based WHO, which had tweeted categorically early in the pandemic. Fact, COVID-19 is not airborne, casting the negative in capital letters as if to remove any doubt. At that time, the agency maintained that the virus spreads mainly through droplets produced when a person coughs, sneezes, or speaks, an assumption based on decades-old infection control teachings about how respiratory viruses generally pass from one person to another. The guidance recommended distancing of more than 1 meter, within which these droplets were thought to fall to the ground, along with hand washing and surface disinfection to stop transfer of droplets to the eyes, nose, and mouth. It took until October 20th, 2020, for the agency to acknowledge that aerosols, tiny specks of fluid, can transmit the virus. But the WHO said this was a concern only in specific settings, such as indoor, crowded, and inadequately ventilated spaces. Over the next 6 months, the agency gradually altered its advice to say that aerosols could carry the virus for more than a meter and remain in the air. But this latest tweak is the WHO's clearest statement yet about airborne transmission of SARS-CoV-2, and it places the virus among a select group of airborne infections, a label long reserved for just a handful of the world's most virulent pathogens, including mycelis, chickenpox, and tuberculosis. The change brings the WHO's messaging in line with what a chorus of aerosol and public health experts have been trying to get it to say since the earliest days of the outbreak. Many decry the agency's slowness in stating unambiguously that SARS-CoV-2 is airborne. Interviews conducted by Nature with dozens of specialists on disease transmission suggest that the WHO's reluctance to accept and communicate evidence for airborne transmission was based on a series of problematic assumptions about how respiratory viruses spread. For example, even in the middle of the fast-moving epidemic, the WHO dismissed field epidemiology reports as proof of airborne transmission because the evidence was not definitive, something that is difficult to achieve quickly during an outbreak. Other criticisms are that the WHO relies on a narrow band of experts, many of whom haven't studied airborne transmission, and that it eschews a precautionary approach that could have protected countless people in the early stages of the pandemic. Critics say that inaction at the agency led to national and local health agencies around the world being similarly sluggish in addressing the airborne threat. Having shifted its position incrementally over the past 2 years, the WHO also failed to adequately communicate its changing position, they say. As a result, it didn't emphasize early enough and clearly enough the importance of ventilation and indoor masking, key measures that can prevent airborne spread of the virus. Lydia Morvasa, an aerosol scientist at the Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia, spearheaded several efforts to convince the WHO and other health agencies of the airborne threat. She says that airborne transmission was so obvious as far back as February 2020, and that omitting it from official guidelines was disastrous. Resolving this debate about how to assess the transmission of respiratory viruses matters, say researchers, because a more deadly variant of SARS-CoV-2 could emerge at any time, and new respiratory viruses will almost certainly plague humanity at some point. It's not clear whether the WHO and the world will be ready.
Ramadan.
My name is Joshua, and I converted to Islam in 2005 when I chose the name Mahdi for my Islamic name. I was very interested in different cultures and religions and new things that you cannot find in a country like Germany. I had a friend who was from Pakistan who owned a shop. One day in the month of Ramadan, the month of fasting, I was invited by him to his mosque. When I came to that mosque, there were several leaflets and books, also a few Qurans, which I looked at. And one Quran that I found was translated to German. When I started reading the Quran, it made me a lot calmer.
Falanwalliyannaka qiblatan tardaha.
I thought to myself, if you accept the hereafter, and if you accept the if you accept that there is one God, or that there has to be a God, then why don't you want to convert to Islam? My first experience of fasting was not in the month of Ramadan, but it was in the month of Rajab, which comes before Ramadan. I started my fast, and I couldn't do it. I had to break the fast in the afternoon at around 3 or 4 o'clock because it was so hot and it was so difficult for me to fast without drinking. I was not even hungry, but the heat and the fact that I didn't drink anything for almost 12 or 11 hours was pretty difficult for me, and it made me break my fast on that day. But I remember the first day of Ramadan in the same year, I did the whole month of Ramadan.
Ramadan is the ninth month of the lunar Islamic calendar. The visual sighting of the crescent moon signals the beginning of Ramadan, which lasts 29 to 30 days. In this month, Muslims fast from dawn till dusk and are encouraged to dedicate a portion of their day to prayer, reading their holy book, the Quran, and reflection. Iran's holy city of Qom has been a hub for Islamic schools and scholars for centuries. The Faizieh School is the most important Islamic school in the world and one of the oldest in Iran. Many prominent scholars of Islam studied here and are now teaching here themselves. Many of them have been influential in interpreting the Quran. Fasting is practiced in other religions like Christianity and Judaism as well.
Fast is just about going without.
Yvonne Ridley is an activist who has reverted to Islam.
Of course, there is fasting in Christianity, but it's more symbolic now. Both Moses and Jesus fasted for 40 days and 40 nights, and we're told that they went without food and water. It was really quite a marathon. Christians, in the run-up to their Easter, go through a period of fasting called Lent, in which they give up something. Quite often it's something like cigarettes or chocolate. So it's quite symbolic, and it's not the daily test that Muslims put themselves through by simply not eating, not drinking, avoiding confrontational situations, having no physical sexual contact and the like.
Layla is an American living in Iran who converted to Islam years ago. She says Islam gave her life direction.
At the time, I was actually searching for a purpose in life, a goal, a direction in life. I knew that Christianity, I was Christian, didn't give me the answers that I really wanted. It wasn't specific enough for me. I wanted something that gave me a reason for why we're here, a purpose. And I liked Islam because it is the most complete religion, and there is a rule or a prescription or a goal for everything you do, an explanation. And that suited what I was looking for.
When Muslims fast, they refrain from eating and drinking all the daylight hours. For a first-time faster, this is a challenging experience, especially when they have to go to work as usual, rain or shine.
Basically, for me, it was a very strange experience. It's sort of exciting, but a little bit difficult to start with, because as you're first starting to fast, you've never really experienced this. not having this ability to, not being allowed to eat or drink anything all day long. So it was a very unique experience the first year. I was wondering at the beginning, I had a doubt if I would be able to actually fast that, because it was more like late summer, fall, and I had a doubt as well I would be able to fast the number of hours because I hadn't ever done it before. And after the first two or three days of adjusting to it, you realize that it's very easy, and you actually look forward to fasting. So it was a little bit of excitement, apprehension a little bit. Can I do this? Can I not do this? How does everybody else do it in a warm climate? You know, just a lot of questions for me to start with for the first time. But as the days went by and you get into this routine, you realize how easy that Allah makes it for you when you fast. It's not difficult, and you learn for the right reasons.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. O my Allah, for thee I fast, and with the food thou givest me, I break the fast, and I rely on thee.
There are certain things a person who is fasting must not do, but they are only the physical aspects of what's going on within the person's heart and mind. In Islamic countries, the fasting month is a national event, and everyone's in the Ramadan spirit. Naturally, this makes fasting more enjoyable and not eating or drinking more tolerable. But in secular countries, it might be more difficult to fast. Europe has more than 44 million Muslims, and the Americas has around 5 million.
I started my fasting at 4 o'clock in the morning, and of course my family, they're going to be hungry at 12 or 1, and they are going to want to eat their lunch. So in a way, it's quite difficult, especially when you are not used to it, to see people eating in front of you and you yourself having to wait. But I think in un-Islamic countries, one thing that converts habit to is that they see all these things happening. They see the most un-Islamic things happening in their countries, in their homes, in their cities, that once they have it, it is easier for them to do a fasting compared to a person who was born a Muslim in an Islamic country or un-Islamic country. So, people get used to that. People get used to it, to see people in the streets drinking ice-cold water or eating delicious foods and you're fasting.
It's quite a difficult time for converts to Islam in the West. Very often their families don't support them, are almost hostile to their reversion to Islam. And because there is so much excitement to the build-up for most Muslims, sometimes converts can get forgotten about. And so they have to cope on their own. And it can be quite a difficult time for Muslims.
Muslims don't only fast during Ramadan. Some also fast voluntarily on the 13th, 14th and 15th of Rajab, the seventh month of the lunar Islamic calendar. Muslims spend 3 days in the mosque praying. It's a form of spiritual retreat called i'tikaf that the Holy Quran and Hadith recommend. Lots of students came to the mosque in the University of Tehran to perform their 3-day i'tikaf. There is also a social aspect to fasting. Community spirit and unity are an important part of Ramadan. Millions of people stop eating at one precise moment and start eating again with the sound of the azan. People give alms to the poor and visit family and friends in the holy month to break their fast together.
I think Islam gives us this opportunity to fast once a year to increase that awareness, that heightened sense of your neighbors and community and society and that ability to help others becomes more aware during Ramadan, because then we begin to feel what sometimes our neighbors are feeling, whereas we may be so busy the rest of the year that we're not aware of that, or we take it with a grain of salt, as we would say. We know it's there, we know it exists, but we still go on with our daily lives.
It is a time for great reflection, and it's a time when you think of brothers and sisters across the world and how they spend their Ramadan and how they spend their fasting. And of course, for a large section of the Ummah, hunger is no stranger to them. There are brothers and sisters out there who survive maybe on just one meal a day, especially in places like Niger, which is often blighted by famine.
The fasting month has some very important nights, the most holy being the nights of Qadr. Muslims believe 1400 years ago on these very nights, the Holy Quran was revealed in full to Prophet Muhammad. Muslims pray and read the Joshan Kabir, Joshan Sagir, and Mujir, among other prayers. They believe they are more likely to be answered on these nights.
This Ramadan, during Laylat al-Qadr, which is indeed a very holy night, or three very holy nights, I would like to ask God for curing many issues that have happened in the world, such as the wars in countries like Syria, or people losing their jobs in any part of the world. But one personal thing that I would like to ask is for forgiveness, because I think that every person, even if he tries not to commit a sin, is not able to not commit a sin, because we're not mas'oom. We are not unfailable. We are human, and human do mistakes. And if people do mistakes and they regret their mistakes, they do not repeat them. So I think it's a good occasion to ask God for forgiveness and to not repeat those mistakes, and keep the connection to God that you have re-established in the holy month of Ramadan in the first 20 days and in the last 10 days of that month.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As everyday Americans continue to struggle during the ongoing pandemic, taxes on the rich remain shamefully low, and billionaires have seen their wealth skyrocket. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading Stain on Democracy. Tax Day study shows U.S. billionaires now own $4.7 trillion. Here's more. An analysis released recently to mark Tax Day in the United States shows that the country's 735 billionaires have seen their collective wealth soar by 62% over the past 2 years, while worker earnings have grown just 10%. Modest gains eaten away by rising costs of food, housing, and other necessities. According to new calculations by Oxfam America, U.S. billionaires now own a combined $4.7 trillion in wealth, much of which goes completely untaxed. As ProPublica recently found in an examination of data from the Internal Revenue Service, an agency that disproportionately targets the poor, the 25 richest people in the U.S. paid a true tax rate of just 3.4% from 2014 to 2018. The billionaire wealth explosion in this country comes at a time of historic inflation hitting working families, compounded by the expiration of critical social safety nets put in place at the start of the pandemic to protect America's most vulnerable, said Gina Cummings, Vice President of Advocacy Alliances and Policy at Oxfam America. Cummings added, "The impact on real people is devastating, leading countless families to slip into poverty. The ongoing failure of our nation's leaders to implement a more equitable tax system is a stain on democracy." Oxfam's new analysis estimates that a series of tax proposals that have been introduced in Congress but have yet to pass would bring in $252 billion in additional federal revenue each year. The version of President Joe Biden's Build Back Better agenda that the House passed in November would cost just $175 billion per year over the next decade. That legislation, which includes clean energy investments and an extension of the poverty-slashing child tax credit boost, is effectively dead in the Senate due to opposition of every Republican, as well as Senators Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. Both Manchin and Sinema have pushed back on Democrats' efforts to hike taxes on the wealthiest Americans. Oxfam notes that Senator Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax proposal would yield $113 billion in federal revenue just from billionaires in 2022, enough to fund an extension of the lapsed child tax credit boost, affordable child care, and soon-to-expire free school lunch waivers. Senator Ron Wyden's plan to tax billionaires' unrealized capital gains, meanwhile, would raise $56 billion a year on average. That new revenue, according to Oxfam, would more than cover paid sick leave, that is $10 billion, family medical leave, $20 billion, as well as affordable child care to allow more mothers and caregivers to return to work by absorbing the crushing cost of care for young families, that is about $24 billion. While the pandemic grinds on, it is shocking to realize and accept that three-quarters of low-wage workers do not have access to paid sick leave, said Cummings. It needs to be said that a vastly disproportionate share of these workers are women and people of color, making this a civil rights issue. This is not just morally unacceptable. It's dangerous for everyone. We can fix this with a small tax on those who have billions to spare. The aid group noted that another $63 billion could be raised by implementing a global minimum tax on multinational corporations, a proposal that the Biden administration and the leaders of more than 130 other countries have backed, but huge obstacles remain in the way of final approval of the tax, given that the legislatures of individual nations have to approve it. Oxfam found that the $63 billion a year in corporate tax revenue could allow the U.S. to invest in climate finance, including tax credits for clean energy, $11.4 billion, and cutting carbon emissions, with tax credits for consumers and companies, that is $32 billion, and fund critical public health needs, including funding global COVID health needs, that is about $5 billion. Covering the uninsured for COVID vaccines and testing, about $1.5 billion. Expanding Medicare for hearing, $8.9 billion, and closing the Medicaid gap, $6 billion. We reject the narrative that this country cannot afford to invest in a better world, protect the planet, feed hungry children, ensure childcare costs do not wipe out a family's earnings, guarantee that hourly workers receive paid leave for illness or the birth of a child, Cummings said recently. The American people have been told a lie, Cummings continued, adding they are paying their fair share to keep this country running. It's time for our nation's billionaires and giant corporations to contribute their fair share of taxes to support the every people who have provided the labor that has allowed them to enjoy record profits and excess wealth. Oxfam America is planning to join activists from Americans for Tax Fairness, Move On, and Daily Cause in delivering petition signatures from more than 500,000 U.S. taxpayers expressing opposition to the glaring inequities of the U.S. tax system. As everyday Americans continue to struggle during the ongoing pandemic, taxes on the rich remain shamefully low, and billionaires have seen their wealth skyrocket, Caroline Fittler, communications director for Daily Cause, said in a statement, adding, "We call on Congress and President Biden to hold billionaires and wealthy accountable." Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're going to be discussing Warriors from the North, directed by Nasib Farah and Sorenstein Jespersen. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Masoud Shajareh, who is the chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Now, Warriors from the North is a complex and multi-layered narrative that gives you a chilling insight into what fuels the current trend of Western Muslim youth leaving the West to join radical extremist groups abroad, such as Al-Shabaab, which is an Al-Qaeda-linked militant group in Somalia. The documentary tells the story of a Danish-Somalian boy in Copenhagen who fell victim to Al-Shabaab recruiters.
We were young men in our early 20s. We missed action. I was very attracted by being able to do something and stop being just one of them who's looked down on, you know? And now Mohammed's in Somalia. He's a warrior for Al-Shabaab. His father, Abukar, is afraid that his son will also become a suicide bomber.
I joined Al-Shabaab because I had nothing else to do and nothing left for it but to join.
We were a true group. We felt that Al-Shabaab showed us respect. I'd never experienced respect like that before.
And first of all, welcome both of you to the show.
Thank you.
And Rich, as our guest film critic, what was your take on Warriors from the North?
Well, it's really, really well made, and it's got that kind of Danish filmmaking sheen to it. Beautifully shot, very clever use of archival footage and stills, and I mean, they make a lot of use of videotape that they get of these warriors, kind of
so-called
really
warriors.
Chilling, yeah. Really chilling videotapes. And but then there's also a lot of footage shot in Copenhagen that's very beautifully shot, very cleverly put together. It's only an hour long. It's a short documentary, so it doesn't. It's not really a kind of comprehensive look at this situation. It's a very specific story about these specific people and in their situation, even though it does have references to the larger story.
And for our viewers who haven't seen the film, in a nutshell, could you just briefly describe what it's about?
Basically, it centers on this man who calls himself the Shadow because he doesn't want to be identified. So you only see him as a shadow on screen, just his silhouette. And he tells his story about being a disaffected youth, basically had a bad breakup and tries to recover by partying and getting drunk, and of course his family doesn't approve of that, so he doesn't really have his family around him, and he's on his own, and he makes all these friends who take him into this closed circle and kind of groom him to go to Somalia, which is where he's from originally, but he hasn't been back there since he was a child. Mm-hmm. So it's, and he tells the story quite coherently. You understand why he fell into this group. He loves the camaraderie of these other men, and then that group dissolved, but some of the men went to Somalia.
And we'll actually touch more on that.
And that's where the film veers. It follows one of his friends who has disappeared in Somalia, and the friend's father is trying to find him there. So you get that parallel story of the father trying to find his son.
Pretty much, essentially, that's what happens. We don't want to give too much away, but Masood, I'd like your take on the documentary. As someone who works on tackling Islamophobia, did you have the same take as Rich?
No, I think the film didn't go out to be Islamophobic. I mean, I actually think it was quite clear that. But I think the environment and the way that the whole thing is within our society, it really came out that way because, you know, as the film was about the franchise sort of youth, getting involved and doing something which is unsavory, you know, say the least. But that happens to a lot of our youth, both Muslim and non-Muslim. And it really didn't tackle that, you know, that aspect. It's sort of what it sort of tackled is that here Islam, you know, it's give the perception that here was an Islam violent sort of thing, an output for them to go and do this. And, you know, the shots, for example, and sort of having discussion in the mosque or having sort of discussion outside the shop with Arabic writing in the back and so forth, it really created that association. Mm-hmm. While in reality, the other side of the story was saying, really, this is not the case. This is just a bunch of youth who are really lost. You
so
know.
You're saying there's multiple messages in this film?
It is, but yes. I think that message was mixed up with some other messages which were sort of visual messages and which is conflicting one another.
Well, that's a really good point, and I'd like to take a brief break now from the discussion. Rich, what did you make of this story and his struggle to bring back his son?
It's quite a wrenching story because he's really worried about his son. He knows that the life of one of these kids who goes to Somalia tends to last about 1 or 2 years before they're involved in some sort of bombing, which is just horrible to think about, for a father to think about his son being taken off there. He doesn't understand why his son even fell into this group. It's pretty wrenching. It's very intense. And also, the Shadow, the other character, who was a good friend of Muhammad, so remember is talking about his friend who's just gone and he doesn't know what's happened to him.
And I think one of the interesting points about this father figure, who probably represents the voice of all the parents struggling to bring back their children who are lost to extremist groups, is that the father is nothing like his son. And I think many people might be surprised to see that usually the idea is that the children become radicalized by their parents. But this isn't the case, is it, Masood?
No, I think this is where I think the documentary failed. Although it was giving messages that strengthened that, but it failed to actually say that, you know, this conveyor belt sort of that is sort of usually talked by British government and other governments that, you know, people start one side and then eventually they become radicalized at the end, which is being disputed by all academics and indeed by intelligence services, but it still is being pushed as a basis of our anti-terrorism sort of strategy. It's not factual, it's actually false. And, you know, this guy, if anything, was quite a misguided group of people, very alienated, all of them. And out of boredom and alienation of where they were actually dragged into that arena. And this was, it was a fact, but wasn't really strengthened.
But this documentary surely is about the personal stories of the individuals, not so much addressing the politics of the situation.
No, but you see, it's very difficult not to, you know, because at the end of the day, that is what makes this very moving. And you know, for example, many of other youth in our society, they might not be Muslim, they might go and join a gang, and they actually end up going as much wrong as these guys gone. And that is something...
Or they get into a right-wing group that commits atrocities at home.
Atrocities at home. I mean, this is, you know, is a really a challenge for our society to, first of all, to understand this phenomenon and then to address it, if possible. And this is sort of did not actually reach that. Look, these youth, although they got involved in this thing, but they were no different to other youth in the society who gets misguided and out of boredom and of nothing to do, and of the fact that, you know, I mean, he was saying, they were saying that that was a group of them coming together, it was a family for them. Mm-hmm. So there was something really lacking in the society.
Rich, would you agree with Masood, what he's saying there, that this documentary should have given more context to what's happening?
I mean, I think since it's just a one-hour documentary, it's very short, and I think they were specifically trying to tell this one story. But they do bring in stories from other people. They have the one, there's the extensive video clips of the boy who went from the UK to Somalia, and then he got out of al-Shabaab. And I wish they had replaced that story with another story of someone in Denmark who found the family in his mosque and didn't, you know, and found what he was missing. And I thought that was what was missing in the film, was the story of someone who found the positive side of Islam, the peaceful side, and, you know, and didn't succumb to violence, which isn't really part of Islam.
Well,
and the film does make that clear. It makes it clear that this violence and these kind of, you know, bombers are not actually Islamic, that's not part of Islam.
I think that's a really important point, that you make that point. And I'm afraid we'll just have to pause it just for now.
Look at the vulnerable young teenagers who have problems with their families, who have problems with the government, who have issues with police, who are an easy target for al-Shabaab, because the person's mind is already crafted and believing, you know, in his own mind, he doesn't trust the police, because the police are the ones that are locking him up and putting him in jail. He doesn't really trust his family, because his family doesn't give him enough support. So what does he do? He comes forward, like me, and joins al-Shabaab. Ends up being killed himself.
You really get a sense of how alienated and isolated these young Somalis feel in Denmark. Rich, do you think this documentary was successful in outlining the reasons why these young Danish Somalis go and fight for al-Shabaab?
It kind of hints at the situation in Europe, where young Somali teenagers are treated like outsiders, so they don't feel like they belong in the society where they've grown up. And these young men have grown up in Denmark, but they don't feel Danish. And they don't really feel Somalian either, because they never lived there, really. So they feel like they don't have any home. And it does really convey that idea. I don't know what's the answer to that. We need to have more open societies that accept people. And maybe the trick is to target prejudice and these ideas that the general public have that marginalize groups of people, but that happens on every level of society, not just ethnically. And
of course, I saw you nodding your head there, Masood. And would you agree with what Rich just said?
Yes, I think. I mean, our society is much more complicated than one issue results in one thing. You know, it's not as simple as that. Alienation is one aspect, and the other aspect is that these are the youth who some of them came across the way that they were being interviewed. They were concerned about injustices around the world, and they wanted to do something about it, which is a very amicable thing to feeling to have. But instead of that feeling being strengthened and supported in the right way of addressing those things, the only thing they could find was actually going and being recruited by these guys. And that is actually a failure that I see in our society day in, day out. And indeed, the government policies and so forth exaggerate this. And the reality is that they're forcing us not to be political, not to address these issues, not to talk. The elephant in the room is being ignored. And the reality is that these youth, and indeed the other youth, are not given the right tools to be, activists in the real sense for the right things, for the right reason, and with the right tools. And if you remove that from any youth, you're actually leaving open very negative aspect to sneak in, because youth want to do something, they want to be part of a solution, and I think we're failing them in that way. Mm-hmm. And the other aspect is that we are giving wrong messages as a society. We actually tell, through our policies overseas and things, we are actually giving message that end justifies the means. Mm-hmm. And that message ultimately is a terrorist justification. And if we give that message could be interpreted and used in other arenas, and people go towards these sort of extreme ways of addressing something which is very, very noble.
And Rich, I get the sense from this documentary that the filmmakers are trying to, while not necessarily directly sympathize with the recruits, but and at the same time they're condemning and showing how horrific their crimes are. Are you getting that sense that the recruits are victims in their own right as well?
Yeah, the film clearly presents them as victims. It presents them as good children who have been brainwashed and kind of convinced that this is the way that they should act and mm-hmm. what they should do. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a sense that it's presenting them as it's not their fault. They're 16-year-olds who have been convinced that what they're doing is the right thing to do, and it does. I mean, our discussion is going way beyond the material in the film, because it is a short film and it is very concentrated on this very specific
story. And that's a merit to the film, because it raises many serious questions.
It causes you to think about these things that it doesn't really address, and that's quite important.
So. And we're going to talk about sort of the vulnerability issue of these recruits.
At one time, I was very seductive to doing this thing. I sort of believed in it for a moment, and I was ready at one time in my life.
I used to think that killing is okay, that, wrapping yourself up with suicide bomb, exploding yourself in the midst of 10,000 people or something was okay. Until I got to a certain level, and I saw that it was wrong, endless, non-stop killing for no reason. When I saw more civilians dying than actual soldiers here in Somalia, that's when I stopped being Al-Shabaab. I wish there's something I can do to stop from all these other kids from getting fooled by the same way I got fooled, being tricked into this endless killing. I want to change.
So it's Mohammed Ali Omar there in that clip, and he's in hiding in Somalia but wishes to return to Europe. And Rich, are there many options for people like him if they wish to return? Because I think he fears of being prosecuted.
Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know what the legal situation for someone like that is. I don't know if he would be... I don't know what he's done. Has he done anything illegal?
But in the film, does it show that path at all?
Yeah, and the film doesn't really go into that. I found myself wishing that was a separate documentary about him, because I think his story is quite interesting and it's more hopeful because it does have it's not finished yet because he is in hiding, but it's a fascinating story to me, and I think, I'm hoping some documentary filmmaker watches this and thinks, and goes and finds him and tells his story
and maybe helps him
reintegrate into European society.
Mm-hmm. And Masood, following from that clip, how is it that young people, and you talked about it earlier, how this film doesn't explain why they're being tricked or how. Could you help explain why and how they're being tricked into mosques and joining in extremist groups?
Well, it really is difficult to say exactly how it's happening, but as I said, there are a number of issues.
Is it that they're taking a literalist interpretation of Islam, perhaps Wahhabism?
Well, what we know that, and this film touches on that, that actually the most ignorant of Islam youth are the ones who actually get recruited. One recruit from Britain, he actually ordered Islam for Dummies, you know, just before going. So this is not something that is motivated by Islam. But unfortunately, our way of combating it is all geared towards we got to find out this Islam and change it. And unfortunately, one thing which I really felt it was wrong in the film, it gives two alternatives. One for the youth to go and be a terrorist, and the other one was actually going to club. And the third option wasn't there. I mean, you didn't look at hundreds and thousands of youth who are Muslim, who are practicing Muslim, who are great contributors. And this stereotyping, unfortunately, is very damaging. I think also the reality is that, you know, on one side, the end justifies mean policy, which West has been pursuing, is the problem. And the other thing is actually, we have got involved from the West with the Saudi regime in creating a new version of Islam for our political sort of needs in the Middle East region. And this has backfired. It backfired in Afghanistan, is backfiring now, is backfiring in Syria. And out of that is actually comes these sort of horrifying ideology of killing everyone, and which it's now interpreted that these are Muslims killing non-Muslims, but the reality is that groups like Daesh are killing more Muslims than non-Muslim, but they're killing everyone and justifying it by Islam, which is which was social engineered as a foreign policy with the help of our Saudi partners. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's definitely way outside of the film, but thank you for the explanation. But I think the filmmakers in this documentary are saying it's easy to write off these groups of people, but I think they want to make viewers think that what role do the West play in radicalizing these individuals? Is that one of the messages, Rich?
I think so, yeah. I think there is that message about why are these kids just left to fall through the cracks of their society? Why is their only option to either become radicalized or go out clubbing and getting drunk? Why are they left like that? It doesn't really examine that. It kind of raises the issue to think about. And I kind of wish it had, but then that's another film. So. Mm-hmm.
And final thoughts for 30 seconds to you, Masood. Would you recommend that people see this film? I know it's only an hour long and it raises many questions, but as a starting point, perhaps.
I do, but I say again, you know, some of the visuals conflicted with the messages it was given. So, you know, different people could watch it and come up with different things. I could imagine very clearly some Islamophobes and extreme right will see it, and it will be justification for all their visions.
So it's open to interpretation,
sure,
I guess.
I'm not sure about that. It does come out fairly strongly about immoral the actions of these suicide bombings are.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, we'll have to leave it there, but we could keep talking all day. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks for tuning in. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Even before hostilities broke out, the CEOs of US major weapons firms were talking about how tensions in Europe could pad their profits. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by William Harting and Julia Gelidil, political analysts. This article is published under the heading Pentagon Contractors Seizing New Gold Rush to Cash In on Russia-Ukraine Crisis. Stay tuned, please, for the first part of this article. Even before hostilities broke out, the CEOs of major US weapons firms were talking about how tensions in Europe could pad their profits. In a January 2022 call with his company's investors, Raytheon Technologies CEO Greg Hayes typically bragged that the prospect of conflict in Eastern Europe and other global hotspots would be good for business, adding that we're seeing, I would say, opportunities for international sales. The tensions in Eastern Europe, the tensions in South China Sea, all of those things are putting pressure on some of the defense spending over there. So I fully expect we are going to see some benefit from it, unquote. In late March, in an interview with the Harvard Business Review after the Russia-Ukraine tension had begun, Hayes defended the way his company would